Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today's award-winning For the People is focusing on a number of developments across our state. First, regarding environmental and energy issues, including the rollback of energy savings program subsidies and the impact of the Revolution Wind project cancellation. So we're going to go right to our number one source on these matters, Connecticut DEEP Commissioner Katie Dykes, to unpack the latest news and issues that can impact all of us. And she'll even give us a few tips on how to enjoy Connecticut parks and forests this autumn. Then we'll tap a couple of our partners at United Way of Connecticut to discuss the ramifications of the latest ALIS report. If you're among nearly half our state residents who are or at risk of becoming ALIS, that's asset limited, income constrained, and employed, you're going to want to tune in. Then, as we move through Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, we're going to learn how Connecticut's 988 Suicide and Crisis Line and the folks who are providing support has been handling the escalating number of calls that have been coming in over the past year. But first, we want to remind you that if you're an agricultural grower or other green industry professional, a landscape service provider, landscape architect and designer, town commission member, municipal official, or just a home gardener, the 5th Biennial Yukon Native Plants and Pollinators Conference wants to see you on Thursday, November 13th at the Yukon Student Union Ballroom in Storrs. Come out for an exciting day of presentations featuring current science-based research and information on supporting pollinators and managed landscapes. Learn how native plants support pollinator health throughout the year. You can even take advantage of an early registration discount through October 15th by visiting s.yukon.edu/nppc2025. Well, as I mentioned in our interview, we always like to go to the ultimate source of information when it comes to important issues, particularly involving things that you may be hearing about in snippets on the radio or on social network or across the back fence, which may not be individually or collectively the best place to get that information. So pleased to welcome the Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, Katie Dykes, this morning for an extended conversation about a number of things that are going on in the state. Commissioner Dykes, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
So let's start with the what I guess for me is the big enchilada, and that is the Revolution Wind development and its potential impact. The information continues to domino from the initial announcement, and it seems like every day we're learning more negative implications of this, while at the same time, it's great to see how many very powerful and informed political colleagues in D.C. and here in Connecticut and across the country, really, and colleagues in Rhode Island who are all going to bat for this continuation of this project.
Yeah, so just to share what's happened, unfortunately, on August 22nd, just a few weeks ago, the federal government, the Department of Interior under Secretary Doug Burgum, issued an unprecedented stop work order halting all offshore wind construction on the Revolution Wind project, which is a project being built by Ørsted, a Danish company, that is 80% complete, and it is set to start delivering power to the New England grid in the second half of next year, in 2026. This is a project that has been in the works for many years. It went through an extensive 9-year permitting process that included, you know, consideration of the issues that the federal government is now purporting to say that need to be reconsidered. And it's employing 1,200 people in the Connecticut and Rhode Island area, along with, you know, many, many more jobs in the supply chain across dozens of states, shipbuilders in Louisiana and cable manufacturers, elsewhere. So it's a project that is going to provide 700 megawatts of power to our grid at a time that we see demand for electricity is increasing as our economy is growing. And we need this domestic source of supply to be able to come online. So certainly those are many of the reasons that we see folks, certainly Governor Lamont and others from power generators in the region to the regional, the New England grid operator, ISO New England, among many others, raising concern about this unfortunate action of the federal government.
Yeah, I have to imagine you're working very closely, or your team is working very closely with Attorney General Tong and his colleague in Rhode Island.
Yes.
As they gear up for the fight.
Yes, we are, fortunate that the Attorney Generals have been taking up the legal battle here to assert, our rights and also working closely with the developer. This is an action that we think, really harms our grid, the reliability of our grid. We saw that confirmed in a statement by the ISO New England just a few days after the stop work order was first issued. We also believe it's going to harm ratepayers. Energy affordability is top of mind for everyone in our state, and so this is a decision that will increase costs for ratepayers. We have some recent analysis that we could expect an additional $500 million in costs, energy costs impacting New England as a whole if this project is halted. Mm. And so those are, among the many reasons that there's concern and certainly an effort to try to halt the stop work order through the courts. But of course, our first preference is to try to work with the administration and see if it's possible to persuade them to rescind the stop work order and help people get back to work. And so certainly Governor Lamont has been leading the charge together with Governor McKee in reaching out to the administration to see if there's a way to get this back on track.
Mm. Well, for naysayers and others who may be skeptical and say, mm-hmm. how can they possibly fix a cost of $500 million a year of negative impact to ratepayers for our utilities? Maybe mm-hmm. you're the right person to be able to unpack and break down exactly how this project, as imagined when it's finished, actually mm-hmm. works to deliver ratepayer savings.
You bet. So first off, let's say that, any new power, generation project like this, they take years to go from contracting through permitting and into construction. So one of the major concerns is that there is no other, large source of generation like this that could be substituted in the time frame, within the next year when this project was expected to come online. And we see that so that will leave us short of electricity generation resources is the concern, and basic laws of supply and demand. If you've got a more limited supply, we start to see energy prices go up. And there's our estimate of that roughly $500 million of impact is based on our knowledge and understanding of how New England's energy markets work. This project has a commitment with the ISO New England to come online next year. And if they're unable to meet that commitment, we will see higher prices in the what's called the capacity market, which is a regional market that the ISO New England administers to you know pay and incent power plants to you know be available in our market to produce power and meet the needs of customers. And so so that's one source of cost, and then the other is that look, offshore wind is very competitive resource when it's operating because wind is free. You know, there's no cost for the fuel, if you will, that powers a wind farm.
And this so wind farm has been cited expertly from a geographical standpoint to maximize the the wind potential, right?
That's right. Folks have, you know, described the New England coast as sort of like the Saudi Arabia of wind. We are very fortunate that we have very robust wind resource just, you know, dozens of miles off of the coast of, you know, of New England. This project is being constructed about 15 nautical miles from the Rhode Island coast. So it truly is a domestic energy resource. It's close to, you know, a very dense region with a lot of residents and businesses that need more power and more low-cost power. And so when this resource, you know, when the wind is blowing, these wind farms can, you know, operate competitively and allow the grid operator to avoid turning on power plants that are more expensive to operate. And so that's how offshore wind helps and other types of renewables help to keep prices more affordable and keep costs down in our energy market. So when projects like this, if they're blocked and prevented through these kinds of political interventions from getting constructed, you know, long after permits have been issued, it's going to have a negative impact on energy costs in the near term and in the long term. I've heard a lot of concern about what this will mean for the, you know, investment climate for, you know, folks looking to build projects, you know, whether they're clean or otherwise in our region. I mean, this sets a terrible precedent for all kinds of, you know, resource types. And that can lead to higher costs, or it could lead to, you know, developers being unwilling to build the kind of generation we would need to meet our you know growing energy demand here in the New England region.
Yeah, I guess it wouldn't be hysterical to suggest on my part that certainly you know the United States is going to be viewed a little bit differently from global players and investors, as you mentioned, who might be interested in developing energy saving programs. It's just unfortunate this kind of got caught up in the spokes here, right in our backyard. Certainly,
yes. Yeah. It's really challenging. And look, I also am thinking a lot about, you know, the men and women that you know we have that are helping to deliver this project that are right now sitting idle, you know, on installation vessels or at the state pier. You know, they've been busy helping to build this project. We have 45 out of 65 turbines have been installed out in the water, and it's been a hub of activity and economic support for the state and for the region. And I know for those folks, they just want to get back to work, and there's a lot of pride in building this project. And these are, you know, many of these are really good paying, you know, union jobs. And that's what we're about, you know, is helping to create, make sure that there's some certainty and, you know, that when a project gets its permits, that it can move forward, and because we're counting on it to help supply electricity next year.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the State Pier project and a similar kind of smaller scale project in Bridgeport, because the Connecticut taxpayers have already made a massive investment in the support network for the Revolution Wind Project, and to some extent, I guess, for what the Fed has invested so far, taxpayers across the nation, there's a big implication there as well.
So the state invested significantly in redeveloping the State Pier into a world-class, heavy lift maritime facility. And developers also contributed significantly to upgrading the pier. It's been a critical resource. I mean, if you drive, if you're passing through New London, I mean, it's really incredible to see the size of these components, the ships coming in. Mm-hmm. It's been busy, all summer, and it's helping to deploy not just the Revolution Wind project, but two other offshore wind projects, South Fork and Sunrise, which were contracted by the state of New York. All told, about nearly 1,800 megawatts of power generation, enough to power more than 1 million homes, all because of this investment in the State Pier. This is the kind of investment in infrastructure, upgrading our infrastructure after so many years, to be able to help build more domestic energy supply. It's a great story and a regionally significant asset down there in New London.
Yeah. Well, let's move from this individual project and refocus a little bit on some looming deadlines, including one that's coming up soon, September 30th. I'm talking about the tens of thousands of dollars in federal rebates and tax credits that are still available to help residents realize savings from purchasing EVs, heat pumps, rooftop solar, and other energy saving initiatives.
You bet. Yeah. So certainly over the last, couple of months, I mean, we've seen a surge in interest. Let me start here to say the high cost of energy and even transportation is really impacting our residents and businesses. And, with inflation and other supply chain challenges, I mean, in recent years, there's really been a lot pinching on people's wallets. And the Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed 2.5 years ago, provided some really important relief for households to provide for more generous tax credits to help residents upgrade their homes and apartments to, put in better insulation or more efficient heat pumps and heat pump hot water heaters and windows, the kinds of things that can really help not just make your home more comfortable, but bring down those high utility bills that unfortunately folks are experiencing more and more as we see, heat waves and more extreme weather impacting our residents. Yeah, you bet. And just the rising cost of energy overall has got more residents asking, what can I do? Is there something I can do to help bring those costs down? And of course, energy efficiency improvements like that are one of the best and most impactful things people can do. And not to mention helping people access, cleaner transportation options like electric vehicles. John, it's, I think, one of the things we know is that there's lower maintenance costs and fuel costs if you drive an EV than a conventional, gas-powered vehicle. And that's one of the reasons that I think we've seen, that there's been a real steady and increasing demand for electric vehicles in our state, all supported by, generous tax credits. But unfortunately, this summer, we saw Congress and the Trump administration in the one big, beautiful bill repeal a lot of those consumer-friendly tax credits. And so what's happening is that starting in just a few weeks, on October 1, the federal tax credit for electric vehicles, which is up to $7,500, will be expiring. And then later this year, we know that tax credits that support building efficiency upgrades and HVAC installation, those will be phased out as well. So, you know, I think Governor Lamont has spoken to, you know, with these steps by Congress, there's certainly going to leave, you know, leave a hole in terms of federal support for things that consumers need. And we're going to do what we can within our budget, you know, here at the state level to help fill in the gaps as much as we can. So one of the things that we are doing is trying to get the word out about programs like our cheaper rebate program, which helps to support making EV purchases more affordable. That rebate is not as generous as the federal tax credit, but it's at $500 right now, and we're looking at the possibility of increasing it after October 1 to help people, you know, continue to, you know, consider an EV purchase. And then we're also encouraging folks to go visit Energize CT website. This is where you can learn about all of the state incentives that we have through Connecticut's energy efficiency programs that can help you better afford or even figure out what kind of energy efficiency upgrades might be right for you. So the bottom line is there's never been a better time to consider you know, getting that EV or installing that insulation, those more efficient windows or a heat pump, you know, acting now is enhances your chances of being able to qualify for these tax credits before they're phased out. But even if you don't, you know, make those deadlines, we still have state incentives that are available. And these are, you know, powerful things that people can do to take control of their energy costs. So visiting Energize CT or learning more about the cheaper program can help start you on your journey to investing in these things. Can help improve your commute and make your home more comfortable and more affordable to heat and cool.
Right. And the bottom line is those who determine they are eligible for the maximum amount of tax credits under this program can reduce mm-hmm. their 2025 taxes by up to $9,500. That is not an insignificant amount for households in Connecticut.
Right. And I think that, again, there's lots of different programs and, you know, it can start to get confusing, but that's why we encourage folks, if you go to Energize CT, sign up for a home energy audit. And we have, energy efficiency vendors all across the state that are part of delivering the Energize CT programs. They'll come out, they'll do an audit of your home, provide, you know, some on the spot, improvements, caulking and weather sealing and so on, to help you start saving right away. But most importantly, they'll give you customized recommendations for what would be the most cost-effective upgrades to make to your home bring those energy costs down. And then that will include some advice about not just state incentives, but what federal incentives may be available as well, for as long as they are available.
Yes. Well, we can't drag you through all this serious business without, a warm ray of sunshine at the end, courtesy of all of the wonderful Connecticut parks and forest lands that are protected and managed by your department. And certainly autumn in Connecticut is when these areas really shine for visitors, particularly from outside the state and even outside the country, who come to little old Connecticut to enjoy a picture postcard fall.
It's, I have to say, it is my favorite season. It's been a busy summer, of course. Sure. You know, we've had lots
no
of visitors.
No kids were left inside. I know that. I'm confident true. No kids were left inside.
But we've got a lot to offer in the fall as well. And the easiest way to connect with our incredible state park resources is go visit ctparks.com. This is a website that we recently relaunched, and And it's a great way to navigate through and figure out, you know, based on if you're into fly fishing or camping or mountain biking or leaf peeping or, you know, a bike ride along the shoreline. We've got so many different options. We've got a park within 15 minutes drive of every resident in our state. And they're very popular destinations for folks outside of Connecticut as well. So just go over to ctparks.com. You know, we've got some great fall weather coming up. It's a great time to get outside, and whether that's going back to your favorite park that you visit every all the time, or checking out a hidden gem that may be new to you or your family, it's a great way to map out a wonderful experience in our state parks.
Very good. And in the last couple moments that we have with you, as recently as yesterday, we'll bring it full circle back around to wind power. Your department has issued an RFP for solar and onshore wind facilities.
Yes. So this is another action that we're taking just to in response to the rapid phase out of federal tax credits for renewable energy. We have put out an RFP, an expedited RFP, as we imagine there may be some mature, solar or wind projects that are that could get built in time to still qualify for the federal tax credits, but may not have an off-taker just yet. So we put out this RFP to consider if there are any, it's kind of last call for projects that may be able to qualify for the federal tax credits. We want to know what they are, and it gives us the shot at considering whether to extend a contract. So that just was issued this week, and we're hoping to get bids a little later in the fall and make some decisions before the end of the year.
Very good. Thank you so much. Commissioner mm-hmm. Katie Dykes from the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. She manages thousands of folks across the state of Connecticut who are working, as you have heard, so diligently on energy savings programs, preservation, protection of our local environment, law enforcement, and public safety, as well as improving Connecticut's quality of life, all thanks to her team and the great work that they're doing here in Connecticut. Commissioner Dykes, thank you so much for your time this morning, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, we always try to look to our sources at United Way of Connecticut when it comes to important information about our states and our residents' health and well-being. And here we are in September, Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and we're going to be talking to the president and CEO of United Way of Connecticut, Lisa Tepper Bates, in a few minutes about the escalating traffic that is being driven to Connecticut's 988 system and the team that operates those critical and vital support lines. But first, and more recently, we have seen the release of the latest Connecticut poverty assessment with some shocking news. When you look at 4 out of 10 Connecticut households, more than 500,000 here in Connecticut unable to afford basic survival needs, according to their ALICE status, ALICE being asset limited, income constrained, and employed. We're pleased to welcome back to the program Daniel Fitzmaurice. He's Connecticut United Way's Director of Advocacy. We're going to speak with him about the issue of ALICE and the escalating pressures on Connecticut's families. We just want to remind you, before we get into that conversation, that the value of public data goes far beyond holding public officials accountable. With access to public data, business owners can determine where to create new jobs, nonprofits and state agency staff can identify issues and develop innovative solutions to address them. And that's why maybe you should consider making plans to attend the Connecticut Data Collaborative's annual conference this year on December 3rd at the Hartford Marriott downtown. You and 250 Connecticut data heroes will come together to strengthen connections and reaffirm our state's commitment to data integrity. You can learn more and peruse the agenda and workshop schedule, as well as register, by visiting ctdata.org/conference2025. All right. Well, Daniel, welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for making time this morning.
Thank you for having us, John.
As we indicated in the introduction, you guys have been very, very busy, and no rest for the folks on the advocacy team here that you're working with. The latest information is gripping, to say the least, disturbing even, and it sadly, doesn't really seem that we've got any relief on the near horizon. Let's hear a little bit about the latest ALIS statistics and this release of this poverty assessment report.
Sure thing, John. And yes, you know we spent the summer really unpacking this information. But you know, as a reminder, you know, it's very, very challenging out there. You know, while we were doing that, you know, families with children were struggling to afford paying for summer camp so they could continue to work through the summer, particularly in late August as we were getting ready to release this information. There hardly are any summer camps available for families. And so, you know, they're making hard and impossible choices about how to make ends meet between housing and food and transportation, healthcare. And also we really wanted to lift up very surely that this is a very extraordinary time in our country, and that does hit home in every town. I'll share a little bit more later about, you know, some of those issues. But, you know, you mentioned the top line issue. You know, we've been doing this report for more than a decade as United Ways across the state. All United Ways in the state participate in this. And we've reached a record. Once again, it's a couple years of records now. So we're at 581,000 households who are living paycheck to paycheck or worse. And, you know, what's notable, John, is that we've been growing that number in our state ever since 2019. Mm-hmm. So it's just going up and up and up every year. And to us, it's very clear that this is a price issue. This is an affordability issue. You know, these are families who are working, you know, multiple jobs sometimes, and they make an okay wage or even a decent wage, but they can't keep up with the cost of everything.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, Daniel, because, you know, in many other states across the nation, the payroll and income that a lot of these 40 percenters are earning here in Connecticut would be enough to afford them all of the necessary basic survival needs, and then maybe even a little bit extra for some for some fun things to do, or you know, get a new refrigerator, some new furniture, or a bicycle for their kid, maybe even throw a few bucks into a savings account. But it really is the cost threshold of everything here in Connecticut that is putting seemingly most of the pressure on these households.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do know how to have fun, John. Buying a refrigerator is a real fun project. But
hey,
we do hear from families all the time that it is when you don't have a savings, right? That's the asset word in ALIS.
Right.
When you don't have a savings, you know, you are one broken refrigerator or one kid getting sick and needing to go to a specialist.
Yeah.
You know, you are one missed shift away from perhaps losing your house. But look, you know, the other thing that I think is really important to say about this information that we're putting out right now is that I mentioned that spike in the overall share of households across the state going up so much since 2019. But, you know, we work in local communities. We work on the ground. So we really wanted to look and see what that says to our towns. And what we noticed, and you can see a map of this on our website at ctunitedway.org/advocacy, is that financial hardship is really growing very fast in places that are typically very stable, or we consider them stable, notably our suburban and rural areas. So I just to make that clear to the listener, you know, there are communities like our more urban centers like Bridgeport and Hartford and New Haven and Waterbury that have very high rates of ALIS households in their communities. But we're not actually seeing a significant change over 2019 to 2023 there. What we are seeing is like in communities like New Milford and Chester and Granbury and Salisbury and Sterling, you know, significant increases, like 15-20% increases in the share of their community that is living paycheck to paycheck.
There's also the phenomena that these pandemic era benefits are aging out or disappeared completely. How much of a role do you think that has played? Because it is just that suburban rural demographic who may have, eked the best benefits from those pandemic era subsidies.
That is very correct. In fact, we've heard a lot from our local partners since we started putting this data out there over the summer, that they're very aware that there are challenges in our suburban and rural towns who are not typically equipped to provide traditional social services. You know, there might not even be a food pantry within a reasonable distance in that area. But the pandemic relief was often provided in cash, you know, whether you think about the expanded federal child tax credit, even the unemployment protection payments that were provided to people. And every town also had American Rescue Plan Act dollars they were spending on various things. That's all gone.
And student loan suspension, right? Even for the younger people.
Yeah. We had a speaker last week who is, a college graduate. I would not call her a younger person. I hope she doesn't mind me saying that. But she's still struggling to pay student loans.
Yeah.
And the student loans are not just an issue that face young people. It hits people for decades after they finish school. And in her case, she's an educator. She's teaching. But again, teachers are one of those common careers in our communities that don't pay as much as it needs to really live in that community. But the other issue that we're noting, and you kind of hit on it, you know, for a while during this increase in that mismatch between prices and wages, families were getting a lot of kinds of cash assistance and other kinds of supports because of the pandemic. That's all gone now. And the opposite is really the case. So, you know, we're really pointing to tariffs as one of the big issues that's going to continue to hit the price issues that we're already struggling to deal with. So just as an example that I think is really relevant for the work we do, already since March of this year, there's an analysis that says that baby gear is up $400 because much of it's imported from other countries like China. And so you're getting the same item like a stroller or a car seat that you do need for your kid. You can't leave the hospital without a car seat that's properly installed.
Yep.
But they cost so much more today than they would have just a couple of months ago. Overall, the tariffs are costing households in Connecticut, according to the Yale Budget Lab. Just this year, it's going to cost everybody $2,400. That's just on average. It could be more or less depending on your spending, what you buy. But again, these are the way the ALIS research works. I mean, these are families that don't have a dollar to spend or an extra dollar to spend, I should say. So there's really going to be some struggles ahead. Or again, families are going to make some hard choices between, you know, filling a prescription and filling the fridge.
Yeah. Well, we can't see the United Way's ALIS identified in any kind of reporting without the words in the same sentence or in the next sentence, including a federal poverty level. Can you just explain to people as simply as possible how the federal poverty level, you know, works as a dynamic against what people are experiencing in terms of shortfall?
Oh, absolutely. We do this a lot because it's a common misconception about, you know, the poverty line, the federal poverty line being a good metric. You know, we just think it's not a good metric. It doesn't tell the full story of what it costs to live where you are. And part of that is because the federal poverty level is established and uniform across the entire country. So let me just give you an example. You know, we talk a lot about two working adults with two children who need childcare. So according to the federal poverty level, they need to make combined wage of $32,000 a year. That's the federal poverty level. If you make $33,000 a year, you're not in poverty by a technical definition. And you brought up the point earlier, John. Yeah. That's the same definition as every other state in the country.
Sure.
So you could see how just that fact alone breaks the concept into two. But the ALICE data, they use real information about what it costs for the basics, you know, nothing frivolous, you know, basic housing, basic childcare, basic food, basic health care, even basic technology. You know, everybody does need a phone yes. these days, right? Yep. So yep. if you put all that in for the same family, the ALICE threshold for that family is a combined wage of $116,000 a year. And so there's a huge gap between $32,000 a year and $116,000 a year. And that's the gap where families feel the most pressure because there are very limited options from a public benefits or even a community benefits perspective for them. There, it's not no options, but, you know, you end up falling off what's called the benefits cliff if you are above the federal poverty level by too much.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to be, you know, we talk a lot about we want families to be above the ALICE threshold. You know, we don't want to be doing this report every year and telling you that the rate of financial hardship is growing. But I think that is going to require some adjustments to how we help families effectively increase their wages in good, great paying jobs, and also making sure we're controlling those costs so that there's a better matchup.
I don't see night or weekend jobs or many gig type jobs, you know, bridging that $115,000 a year gap between the federal poverty level universally and what a Connecticut
that's what,
average
that's what families try to do, though. Yeah, we talked to a family over the last week who spoke at our press conference, and she said, look, I've been working as many double shifts as I can this year because I know what my bills are coming up. She noted the child care bills for summer camp in particular. It's like, I knew we were going to have to pay, you know, upwards of $300 or $400 a week for summer camp for my two kids. And so all that means is I'm working double time, and that means I'm spending less time with them. And that means I'm experiencing all the stress that comes with working 60 hour weeks. And, you know, again, these are families who do know what to do, and they're working really hard. They're good at making money and managing their money.
Yeah.
And again, these are jobs that have to be done in our community.
Sure.
We can't go without, you know, medical assistants and paraprofessionals in our schools and cashiers in our stores and restaurants. Right. These are not optional jobs in our community. They are necessary, but the stress that comes with not being able to afford to live is what is not necessary.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, Daniel, as we get into our last minute or so here, because when anybody says, hey, I'm doing okay, you know, it's not my problem. In fact, it's things like that stress that a year, 3 years, 5 years down the road are going to be putting much more immense pressure on our public health systems and the taxpayer dollars that go to offset care for people who are experiencing other more drastic health emergencies as a result of the stress that they're suffering because they're working 60, 70, 80 hours a week to barely scratch the surface of what they need to have a normal lifestyle here in Connecticut.
We hear it all the time in conversations with families. It's the hardest part about living paycheck to paycheck is it's hard to emotionally navigate that. It's not a technical problem related to budgeting, right? These are folks who do know how to pinch every penny, and they're happy to do that. but the every night stress of being just one bill away from maybe losing your home or having your kids go without food is a real hardship that should be avoided at all costs.
Well, if anyone looks to the neighbor to their left and then they look to the neighbor to their right, one of those individuals is likely one of the 40% of Connecticut households, over 500,000, 538,000 households unable to afford basic survival needs in 2023. We appreciate being able to go to you, Daniel Fitzmaurice, to get filled in on all the latest information. And sadly, perhaps the reason behind why another aspect of United Way of Connecticut, their 988 Suicide and Crisis Support Line, is experiencing such a increase trend in usage and demand. And we're going to be talking about that next with the president and CEO of United Way of Connecticut, Lisa Tepper Bates. So we'll say farewell for now, Daniel, and pick up on the line with Lisa and talk a little bit more about 988 here in September. Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. Thanks, Daniel. All right, as promised, we've now switched gears and are on the line with Lisa Tepper Bates. She is president and CEO of the United Way of Connecticut, a great friend, asset, and resource here to the award-winning For the People. Lisa, great to hear your voice again. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me on to talk about this important month and this important service.
Yeah. So this is the second of two interviews we've done here in September, Suicide Prevention and Awareness Month. And you and I have had the opportunity again on this just a few days after the second annual 988 Day on September 8th to talk about this critically important and stepped up service that's available, not just across the nation, but right here, homegrown in Connecticut with, you know, Connecticut folks serving to support Connecticut folks who are dialing 988. So to start the conversation, let's just recap a little bit about the change that we experienced as a nation when 988 was introduced and the distance that we've come in a positive direction, both in terms of the development of the processes, protocols, and technology of 988 and how it is able to respond to this escalating need, especially here in Connecticut.
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. We have seen a growth in the demand for this important service. United Way of Connecticut has provided suicide and crisis lifeline support to Connecticut for more than 40 years. But the 988 three-digit dialing code launched in 2022 and was an important step forward. People can remember it easily. There's been good national advertising to promote awareness. And indeed, in the past year, we handled more than 55,000 calls on 988 Connecticut, which, John, is 2.5 times the number of calls on the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline that we received in 2022. So I think that tells you something about awareness and about the need for that support.
And also how well it works. Have you got a handle on either officially or anecdotally on whether this is actually moving the needle in terms of downtrending actual crisis and suicides?
Well, thank you, John. That, I believe, is the most important question. And what we hear from 95% of our callers in Connecticut is that their state of crisis diminished on their call with our team. I don't think there's anything more important. But another important indicator as well is the fact that in less than 1% of our crisis calls, do we have to refer to active rescue with first responders? And that's really important, too. A lot of folks who may be in a crisis may be concerned that if they call, that a police car is going to show up at their house. They do not want that. Mm-hmm. Now, if we have to, and working with the caller, we will work with first responders. And sometimes that is what's needed. But we really try very hard to refer folks to other resources. That can include, for some, that might include, you know, going to a local support group tomorrow. For others, it may mean picking back up where they are with a therapist or other sources of support that they have now. And for some folks, it may mean in creating a connection with a mobile crisis team that's also available in our state. So we really try to be as sensitive and as respectful as we can, working with each caller to connect them to what will work best for them. And that very, very low rate of having to engage first responders for active rescue, we think also speaks to the important effectiveness of our team.
Well, Lisa, it sounds like not only is the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline preventing the initial tragedy of loss due to suicide, but also is playing a critically important role in connecting these people in crisis to a network of support that may be the lifeline for their future.
I think that's a great way to put it, John, and that is exactly right. We have a comprehensive database of the resources available to help people, and we work very hard with every caller to have a plan, to offer them help, to establish a plan that will work for them going forward.
Mm. And really, I mean, 988 is relatively new. It's still a growing movement and service, developing and tweaking to become even better and more effective across the nation. But here in Connecticut, we've had this type of resource available to people thanks to Connecticut's 211 info line for decades.
That's right. And at the same time, there's a new frontier that we are working to make sure that we can also be available for. And that is the increase in chat and text, John. There are a lot of people who do want to speak over the phone to a human being, but we have a new generation of Americans who are often more comfortable, even in a crisis, having that communication by chat and text. And I'm really pleased to tell you that as we have continued to ramp up our 988 service, we are building out additional capacity so that we can, in Connecticut, be here and be ready to respond to all chats and texts from Connecticut residents who are in crisis.
And in the last couple of minutes we have with you, Lisa, let's talk about responsiveness from those early days when we were hearing, sadly, a lot of negative reports from people who may not have gotten connected as soon as they needed to when they dialed 988. Today, I'll let you say the number, 97% of calls being answered here in Connecticut within how many seconds?
Within 5 seconds, John, which is amazing. It's as fast as you would pick up the phone if a dear friend was calling. And we're pleased about that. And that is also so important. In these critical calls, we know that your speed to answer that call is of utmost importance to the person in crisis on the other end. And so we're proud of that very fast response time, which consistently beats the national goal of answering 95% of calls in 15 seconds.
And please spend the last minute extolling the virtues of your switchboard team.
Yeah, thank you, John. This is being a crisis contact specialist is such an important job, and it's a hard job. All day, every day, overnight, our folks are really ready for whatever may be the situation when they pick up that phone. And they treat every caller with respect and with empathy. And with every caller, they are working with that person as an individual to de-escalate their sense of crisis and to help them with a plan going forward so that, they can get on a path to feel stable and to thrive. And that's our goal with every caller every day.
Connecticut's 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline provides judgment-free, compassionate support to anyone experiencing emotional distress, mental health challenges, problems with substance use, loneliness, and thoughts of suicide or self-harm. Here we are in September, National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and certainly the right time to focus on this important service, this life-saving resource brought to you thanks to all the great folks at United Way of Connecticut, including our guests today on the program, earlier speaking with Daniel Fitzmaurice, their Director of Advocacy regarding the latest ALICE report, and of course, always welcoming their president and CEO, Lisa Tepper Bates, who's such a great advocate for this 988 and 211 services provided by her agency. Lisa, thank you so much for your assistance and information this morning.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.